Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. This year, there's a contested election for the seat of retiring Montana Supreme Court Justice Patricia Cotter. Montana District Court Judge Dirk Sandifer is one of the two candidates. The winner will join the other six members of the court, who are charged with the sober responsibility of interpreting and upholding our state constitution. Judge Sandifer, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thank you, Brian. I'm happy to be here, and thank you for this opportunity to speak to Montanans.
Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
My dad was an auto body mechanic for 35 years, Korean War veteran from Malta, Montana. And my mother was a medical technologist for the entirety of her career. She's also born in Malta, Montana. And at some point, they migrated to Great Falls, and I was born and raised in Great Falls, and grandparents remained in Malta, and so I have some connections there, at least until recently.
Now, your judgeship is in the Great Falls area, is it not?
It's in Great Falls in Cascade County. I'm a state district judge, and we have statewide jurisdiction.
If I asked you what central values you learned growing up with those parents in that life, what would you say?
Honesty, integrity, and as my dad said a million times, pay your bills.
Are your folks still alive?
My mom died when she was in her early 40s from a progressive disease, and my dad died here recently at the age of about 77.
You mentioned your values. Those are strong values. Do you think that the experience of life and the values that derive from it impact a judge's decision in interpreting the law?
They absolutely do, and I feel particularly blessed to have the wealth of experience, lifetime experience that I've had over the years. It gives me perspective to deal with people that come before the court in a myriad of situations, and I think that it has served me well in the service of Montanans on the district court bench.
Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, Roberts, argues the judge calls balls and strikes. And I think the average person would look at the law and say it should be interpreted the same by all judges. But the implication of what you're saying is that your values and philosophy matter.
Well, I think that they matter from the standpoint of giving you some understanding of the myriad of factual circumstances from which these cases come to the court. And they give you insight into what happens to people, what drives people. At the end of the day, however, the court's function is to apply and interpret and enforce constitutional and underlying legal principles to the myriad factual circumstances that come up in cases and let the chips fall where they may. And sometimes as a judge and a caring and thinking person, you have to reach results that you don't necessarily like to see, but they have to be driven by the law and the facts of these cases.
As a somewhat student of the United States Supreme Court, it seems to me that political philosophy affects how a judge sees the facts, perhaps, and influences decisions. Do you believe that is true?
I think, unfortunately, that is true in many cases. It certainly has not been my experience. I certainly have my own political views, but they are mine, and they don't belong on the bench. And I have a 14-year career in one of Montana's busiest judicial districts of deciding cases based on the facts and law without any consideration of my personal political views or other philosophical views that I have. And I would defy anybody to find any case that I've decided over the last 14 years that has any hint or indication whatsoever of any personal political bias or philosophy.
I'm hearing you say that one's life experience and the values that derive from that life experience inform decisions, influence decisions. It's not just, quote, the letter in the law. Maybe it's filling in blanks that aren't covered by the law. I don't know. But that in your case, your political philosophy is off the table. Do I understand that correctly? Because it's hard for me to make the distinction.
Absolutely. I think the distinction that should be made there is that your life influences and experiences, as I indicated earlier, can and should give you common sense and other intuitive insights into the circumstances, the factual circumstances that come before the court and the situations that people and litigants find themselves in. And certainly when we are applying the law, we shouldn't check our common sense at the door and our core values, but where the line is, you cannot have, and we cannot have as a society, individual personal values or ideological values of associated groups driving or influencing judicial decisions. We have to keep that out of the court. It doesn't belong there.
Now, the judicial canon of ethics says that you can't comment on cases that are likely to come before you or something like that. But at the same time, I think it's important where possible for the citizens to get an idea of how you approach certain kinds of issues. And there are various precedents that are in the past. Let's talk about private property rights. There was an elk farm bill, I think it was actually a citizens' initiative, that passed maybe 10, 15 years ago, I'm getting old, lose track of time, that prohibited the continuation of elk farming for commercial purposes. It went to the court and the initiative was upheld. Did you have an opinion at the time about whether that was a right, wrong decision and why?
I don't have an opinion about that, because I think it would be irresponsible for me out of my pocket to give you some reaction to that without taking a hard and detailed look at that case. And my response upon taking that type of review on the case wouldn't likely be based upon whether I agreed with the result or effect of the decision. I think that the only fair evaluation of judicial decisions are not whether you or particular groups of people agree with the result of the decision, but rather whether the court fairly, properly, and conscientiously and reasonably applied the applicable constitutional and underlying legal principles to the facts of the case. And I think, unfortunately, what's happened in recent years in the media perception and evaluation and resulting public perception of judicial decisions is that people who have definite interests in one outcome or another try to imprint that value on the court, depending upon whether or not the court decision was in their favor or not. And in some situations, particularly in the federal courts, I think that is sometimes fair criticism. Generally, I don't think that has been fair criticism in Montana. We have to understand what the role of the court is and is not. The court is not a policy-making body. The court should not be second-guessing the legislature. The court should not be acting as a super legislature, imprinting its own policy views on the public.
I'm pursuing the question because there's a constitutional issue at stake. It's a phrase out of the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution, nor shall private property be taken for public use. And there have been a lot of federal cases and obviously state cases. For example, zoning. Is zoning, as a general concept, restricting the use of private property through a process of a legislative body, a taking or not a taking? What would you say in general principle? How would you explain that to the citizenry?
You probably know from the nature of your question, the concept of zoning historically was very controversial. And when it came to the fore in this country, there were a number of court challenges that asserted just that, that it was an unconstitutional infringement or taking in the constitutional vernacular of private property rights. And in essence, and this is a little bit of an overgeneralization of it, the United States Supreme Court, I believe it was the Euclid case, not that that's particularly informative in this interview, found that it was zoning was a legitimate use of the government's police power to impose reasonable restrictions on the use of private property. And the ruling wasn't that government regulation could never rise to the level of being an unconstitutional taking, but in general terms, it was not, because it was within the wheelhouse, so to speak, of the general police powers, public safe welfare, and safety that the general state governments have.
Let's take something from the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting free exercise thereof. There was recently a federal district court case a few years back on whether or not creationism could be taught, intelligent design, I should say, be taught in public schools. The ruling was no, that it was religion, not science. Now, that's a whole controversial area of the law, from gay marriage to active expression of one's faith in the community as opposed to just in the church. Did you have an opinion on the results of that case in terms of teaching intelligent design?
No, I don't. I don't have an opinion about that. I'd have to, again, have to take a look at the case, and I think it would be irresponsible for me to state an opinion here today without having reviewed that. I don't necessarily have a problem with that from a knee-jerk standpoint, but it's just difficult for me to state a general opinion on something like that without looking at the analysis that the court adopted in the case and then trying to have a discussion either about how it was applied to the facts at issue or in the case, or if we're trying to project that onto a more contemporary fact pattern.
I appreciate that, as you know, as a judge, you're used to withholding decisions until you see all the facts and hear both arguments. You're also a citizen and a lawyer. And so I don't think it's unfair to ask the questions I'm asking, and you're entitled to answer any way you see fit, and I appreciate your response. One more. The striking down by the Supreme Court of the state of Montana of the gay felony statute made consensual same-sex from adults a felony. Did you have a reaction?
Well, my reaction was is that without getting into the often controversial public dispute or philosophical or moral dispute about same-sex relations was that it was a constitutionally correct decision and, frankly, a no-brainer given the then-existing state of the federal constitutional law. And that's not an endorsement by me or a condemnation of me, by me, of either side of that debate, but that was a pretty simple legal decision for the court.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with District Court Judge Dirk Sandifer, candidate for the Montana Supreme Court. Earlier you mentioned, I think, that words to the effect it was inappropriate for political values, political philosophy, or political influence to make its way onto the court. We have elected judges. You're running for the court seat. People support our election system with private money. In the last election, there was a lot of out-of-state money that came in. There's often a lot of lawyer money that comes to the candidates for the court. How do you feel about that? Because with money often go strings or expectations of decisions in one's favor. From a business standpoint, I'd say these are investments.
Well, I think that it is in the executive branch sense and in the legislative branch sense. I think it can be a corrupting influence in the judicial sense as well if judges can't find the balance between what they need to do to go out to raise sufficient money to campaign for office, as Montanans have stated since the dawn of this state, that we want to have our judges elected. But all I can speak for is myself. I ran for office, judicial office, for the first time in 2002. And at that time, the campaign contribution limit was somewhere around $100 or per person. I don't even recall. It's been so long now. And I found, somewhat naively, after I was fortunate enough to win, that there were people who expected to have some influence over me because they wrote me a $100 check. And they, of course, found out right away that it didn't work that way and that although I appreciated their check, my integrity was not for sale. And I think, however, that is something that, unfortunately, is dependent upon the integrity of individuals, and I think that's why it is brought into concern when people look at this from a system standpoint mm-hmm. and say whether or not it's a good idea to elect judges. There are pros and cons.
What's your view?
At the beginning of my career, when I didn't have any particular experience or expertise, I was all for electing judges because there is no way that a person like me at that stage of my career would have been appointed, frankly, to the state bench because I probably wouldn't have qualified, frankly, on merit. But I was able to go out to the public and convince the public that I had integrity, that I had the capability to the job, and I was able to get elected and prove myself, which is what I've done over the last 14 years. At this stage of my career, where I'm very well established and very well known around the state as a highly competent and highly experienced and fair and impartial judge, I would self-servingly say at this point that I would prefer judges to be appointed on a merit-based system because I think clearly, without being arrogant, I would be on the top of that scale.
Carla Gray's proposed former Chief Justice of the Montana Supreme Court appointment, followed by what I will call a validation election contingent upon people being satisfied with the performance of the justice. Do you support that concept?
I don't know, because I gave you my last answer with some degree of facetiousness. It's a hard question because I think that generally the citizens of the state of Montana over the years have got it right. Now, these elections are not always pretty, and there are reasonable criticisms and concerns about whether we should have judges elected. But I think if you look backwards to, except for the corruption of the Copper King era in Montana, mm-hmm. Montanans have got it right, generally, with their selection of judges, both at the Montana Supreme Court level and at the state district court level.
Just one more question on this issue. I don't know what the Citizens United case did for judicial elections, if there was any distinction or not between them and legislative and executive branch elections. But we're seeing money that's not $100. We're seeing hundreds of thousands. I think last year, both last election, the contested race between Van Dyke and Mike Wheat, $1 million apiece, something like that. It seems to me as a citizen there is clearly the potential for corrupting influence. Would you disagree?
I would absolutely agree with that, and certainly the appearance of it, if not the actuality of it, in a particular situation.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with District Court Judge Dirk Sandifer, candidate for the Montana Supreme Court. You said earlier it's not the job of the court to second-guess legislatures, or words to that effect. A fair number of cases go to the Montana Supreme Court or the United States Supreme Court, where the allegation is the legislature has violated someone's fundamental rights. We talked about the gay marriage statute. I go back, I'm old enough to remember segregation of, segregation period in schools, struck down by Brown versus Board of Education, 1954. When you look at the Constitution of Montana, Article 2 is a declaration of rights. It includes popular sovereignty, self-government, inalienable rights, which include the right to a clean and healthful environment, individual dignity, etc. In your opinion, are those fundamental rights, and if, with that question is the question, if a legislature infringes on those rights, does the doctrine of strict scrutiny of the court apply?
Absolutely it does, and let me back up for a minute, because in regard to my earlier answer, I think that what I said was that it's not the role of the court to second guess the legislature in the public policy area, which is under our constitutional form of government, delegated to the legislature within the scope of its power. To clarify that in regard to your question, it really should say it's not the role of the, I should say, it's not the role of the court to second guess the legislature when the legislature is acting within the limits of its constitutional power. However, it is the role of the court, when cases come before the court where it is challenged that the legislature has exceeded the limits of its constitutional power, it's the role of the court to enforce the Constitution, and if it finds, the court finds under the Constitution that the legislative enactment goes beyond the legislative power and infringes constitutional rights, fundamental constitutional rights, it's the role of the court to strike down that legislation. But when the court does that, it's not commenting on the merit of the legislation from a public policy standpoint. Essentially, what it's doing is saying, legislature, you're entitled to your view on that, but you've exceeded your power by infringing on fundamental constitutional rights that are guaranteed to individuals by the Constitution.
To take one more right that's listed in the Montana Constitution, the right to keep and bear arms is an emotional and very powerful issue. Some advocate that that is should include and does constitutionally include the right to carry a concealed weapon. Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, first of all, I'm a former police officer and carried a gun for a living and feel comfortable with it as a means of self-defense. I have a concealed carry permit issued by the Cascade County Sheriff. I don't carry that often, but in this job where I'm sometimes subject to death threats or threats of harm to me or my family, I've taken that measure. So obviously, I believe very strongly in the Second Amendment protections of our right to bear arms. Now, where those parameters are in relation to various issues that come before the court have to be looked at very closely on a case-by-case basis. The legislature in this state and the law in this state as a result of action by the legislature has provided by statute that there are provisions for citizens to carry concealed weapons. That is the current state of the law in Montana, as long as that is approved through the application process through the local sheriff. Now, the question that you ask is whether or not there's a fundamental constitutional right under the Second Amendment to carry a concealed weapon independent of legislative authorization. I think that that's a more problematic question. I think that you have to start from the standpoint that the original intent of the framers was very broad in their understanding at that time, and that's where you start in that analysis. And I think that those are very controversial issues. I probably shouldn't comment much beyond that without getting myself into a situation where I'm taking a position on a case that could potentially come before the court. So I don't want to dodge the question, but I think that's as far as I can go with that under ethical rules.
The Bill of Rights is framed largely in terms of individual rights, protecting it from governmental intrusion. Yet when we were talking about zoning, for example, the police power would be, whether it's your experience as a police officer or the general police power to control certain aspects of public behavior that the government has at different levels, the implication is that the public has rights as well. They're not enunciated in the Bill of Rights, but the preamble to the Constitution refers to the general promoting the general welfare. What's your assessment of the idea of public rights?
Well, that's been very controversial over the course of the history of this country as to just what was intended by the framers in that regard, because I don't have the text of the Constitution in front of me, but there is language in the federal Constitution to the effect that the rights that are not granted to the federal government are reserved to the people. Mm-hmm. That has come up several times over the years, and particularly from the 1960s forward, and remains, in my view, a controversial and somewhat open issue in federal jurisprudence as to just exactly what was the intent there and how far does that go. But I think the more fundamental point that you make, and I agree with it, is that both in regard to the federal Constitution and in regard to our own Montana Constitution, these are not standalone documents. They originate from the self-governing power of the people. And although it doesn't happen very often, the people retain, both under the United States Constitution and under the Montana Constitution, the right to revise our constitutions from time to time as we see fit, as part of the social compact that we live under here in this country and in this state. And it's very difficult, as it was intended, to amend either the federal constitution or the state constitution, and it should be, because the constitution needs to represent the general will of the large body of people, not just the majority or some vociferous segment thereof.
Sometimes fundamental rights come into conflict in real life. Hypothetical example, maybe not so hypothetical. Gay couple gets married. A businessman says, I won't bake a cake for you. I don't believe in gay marriage. My religion, my faith, says it's a sin. He's exercising his religious freedom, one might argue. They're married, they're entitled to not be discriminated against. As a judge, without, you can use those specifics or any other specifics you want, when rights come in conflict, what's the role of the court, fundamental rights?
Well, the role of the court when rights are truly in conflict is to attempt to balance those rights within the framework of the constitutional sources from which they originate, whether it be this federal constitution or the state constitution. But I think what we need to remember, whether it's in that context or other contexts, the constitutional protection of rights was to protect us from the government. In the religious context, it was to keep the government out of the exercise of religion. It was a shield against the government, not a sword to use against others in the exercise of their constitutionally protected rights. So when we have that discussion, we have to start with what are the contours of these rights, and are they a shield, are they a sword, where are we at here? Do we even have a conflict in these rights to start with?
I'd like to end with a couple of personal questions. You've been a judge for 14 years. What have you learned that you didn't know in the beginning?
I learned something new every day. That was the first thing that I learned when I came on the bench, is that you never stop learning. And it's not a cliche to say that you face new issues all the time, even though the legal principles are fairly static. The circumstances under which they arise changes, and the law is always being pressed by various forces in these cases, and it's a learning experience and will be to the day that you get off the bench.
Secondly, why are you running for the court?
I'm running for the court to maintain the integrity of the court under our state and federal constitutions in the face of increasing politicization of the court by out-of-state corporate money and others who are attempting to buy the court to reshape it in their own image for their own purposes to the detriment of all Montanans.
Judge Dirk Sandifer, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.